Welcome to a very special episode of Beyond Zero. I'm your host Ben. Joining me today is Adam Levine. Today we are here to celebrate the Bar Mitzvah edition of the Instructions. Mazel Tov, and thanks for joining me, Adam.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Beth.
You're back in Chicago now after a stint in Florida. How's life over there? And what have you been up to since we last spoke?
Life here is great. It's my hometown. I love it. I'm really thrilled to be back. I don't know, since last we talked, when did we last talk?
I think we talked in December.
In December, yeah. So, no, same old. Just writing every day, reading a little less weirdly, but not less weirdly, but less, comma, weirdly. Mm. But just sort of a slump, but hoping to pick that up, pick up again, you know? So,
Nice. It feels really apt that you're back in Chicago because the book we're going to talk about is set in Chicago. And I kind of want to move on to that straight away because we've got so much to speak about. So we'll talk about the Bar Mitzvah.
Sure.
So the original 1,000-page brick that I have here from McSweeney's, which is fucking massive and amazing, it came out in 2010. The book itself is presented a piece of scripture, I suppose, by a young Torah scholar named Gurion Ben Judah Maccabee. He's been kicked out of every yeshiva in Chicago, ends up at this school for kids with conduct disorders and things like that. It's called Aptakistic, which is a great name. He's in a program called The Cage. Gurion is almost a cross between Gaddis's JR and Bar Kokhba. I have a contention. This book is the most authentic and unapologetically Jewish book possibly ever, but certainly since Goodbye Columbus. Before we speak about the book itself, can you tell us the origin story of this book? Because I feel like, you know, Gurion is like a superhero and I think he must have an amazing origin story. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, I'm afraid to disappoint you. I started out, when I started writing it, it was really actually just like the way I write anything else, which is I wrote a few lines and I liked them. And so I went forward and it started like really quickly. I had this idea. I was like, okay, it's going to be a kid who has this sort of Messiah complex. And then like, by the evening of the first day when I was thinking he's going to be a kid who has a Messiah complex, I thought that's a bad idea. And I thought, well, so what it'll be is he'll be just, it'll be a messianic allegory. And then by the time I went to bed, I was like, well, actually that's a bad idea because Cool Hand Luke already did that really well. And any number of things did it well. And so I thought, no, it's going to be a kid who actually might be the Messiah. But he's going to have this voice that is a voice that's like pretty pugilistic and like kind of, you know, weird. And he's going to be 10. And like I knew that from what I'd written already. And then sort of I tried to figure out how to make that, you know, be a thing for the next 9 years. so that's kind of the origin story of it. I think that's, if that's what you're asking.
So it took you 10 years to write this?
Yeah, almost. Yeah. Very close.
Okay.
Yeah. About nine, yeah.
McSweeney's is putting out a new 2-volume edition of the book. I don't know if you've seen it yet because we were just talking about production delays and things like that. So the book's actually coming out in May, fingers crossed. But do you want to tell us about this new edition and how it looks? I've seen the cover. The cover looks amazing. But tell us about this new 2-volume edition.
Well, so the idea with the edition was there need to be a new edition because they're all sold through and like of the old ones. And so my thought was that it's actually like, I love how big the original is, you know, like physically, it's pretty stunning. And I love the cover and everything, but also it actually kind of as I age, it hurts to hold the book. It's like, it's a really large book and it's many pages. And so I was like, this should be in 2 volumes. And I read I'd read 2666 in that three volume paperback
Mm.
edition,
Yeah.
and I thought that was a beautiful edition, and I wanted multiple volumes, and McSweeney's was cool with that. And then it became this conversation about, who would write an intro, and Gabe Bump agreed to do it, and he's this awesome young writer who actually was a student of mine at some years ago. And the covers was just that was a weird one, because that was like they're basically like what's kind of great, what I appreciate they've done. We'll see if this shifts in their strategy or whatever, is like, so it's two different covers. They're all and they have two different back covers too. And they're these sort of fully illustrated things that, if they're put together and flattened, they make this kind of mural. That's like, the idea was to make it sort of like a Diego Rivera mural. And so there, and it's like, with a very different style, but similar in that things are taking place sort of non-consecutively. It's a bunch of different events that are important in the book. And the thing that was cool is that the two front covers, which are the ones that are shown online, which I really like, are the weaker. The back covers are the coolest covers.
Oh,
And
wow.
so those aren't shown, and like it's like and so I'm kind of psyched for people to see those. Like, those are, at least to me, those are the most exciting parts of that mural. And so we did that, and that was fun. Like, it was really different. With the first cover, I wanted, like, initially, like, I wanted just like a black cover, or a white cover. Like, I just wanted nothing. And then we settled on this sort of designy thing. And with this one, I was like, no, it could be more illustrative. Like, it'll be fun, because a lot of people who are going to get it are probably people who already know a bit about the book. It's not, it's been around for a while, so it's not like a spoiler cover. It's just like, here's some things in there. And and yeah, I think the artist Jeffrey Camden did this really great job with it, man. So it was real, yeah.
One of the, like, I'm just looking at the photos of the covers that are online at the moment. There's one where you can see Gurion in a tree, and he's kind of got this like cloudy background with light running through it down to his followers, and it does look kind of like something you'd see like, in a Haggadah or something like that, or like it's got that whole biblical thing happening, which is just really cool. It's just I cannot wait to get my hands on this book.
I think it's gonna be pretty. I still haven't held one, so knock wood, it'll come out as good as it looks online. So yeah.
Cool. All right. I want to ask you more about the book itself, because we start with Gurion. He is an amazing character. Like I said before, I think that he's much like JR in the fact that he can speak nonstop. He's obviously a prodigy. He's got this conduct disorder. He admits to having ADHD. We get kind of his history of getting chucked out of these schools. So we find out quite a lot about him quite early in the book. He's also a pretty well-rounded Talmud scholar, I suppose. We meet his mum. She's a former IDF commando, and she's now a psychologist. And his father kind of grew up Hasidic, but he's at a wedding when he's younger, and Milovavitcher Rebbe does a nice cameo, and he gives him this message at this wedding that has to do with Gurion, which we find out much later. But he ends up just going on to his career as a lawyer. And Gurion, like as a character, we kind of get to know him when he's at this school. And he basically starts a militia to overthrow the school administration, including a very amusing Australian man who's involved as well. His followers believe he's the Messiah. And one of the lines that I think that really sets the book up nicely that he delivers early in the book, I'm going to paraphrase because I haven't got it written down, but basically he says to his dad after doing something bad at school, he's like, "I didn't break any laws, I only broke the rules." And I think that really sums up the way he looks at the world. Can you tell us about Gurion and kind of, I guess, what your inspirations were for him as a character? Because I think he's just probably one of the most brilliant single narrator characters that I've read in a very long time.
Well, thank you. I mean, like, well, that so that like line that line that you quoted, I mean, like, I think that's sort of like a kind of distillation of like what how my mom told me to kind of approach kids that fucked with me at school. Like, I was a little bit of a fat kid, and I got a lot of fights. And she th there's this whole thing. I don't think it was just me. I think it was a lot of people around where I was growing up, because there was like a fair amount of fighting. Relatively harmless kid fighting, but like, it felt serious. And I think that, that was before zero tolerance and all that. And the idea was that it's against the rules to fight, right? But like those are school rules. And like what you really shouldn't, what your parents, what my mom didn't want me to do was start a fight, right? Like that's not okay. That's sort of like the law, right? But if someone fucked with me, I was kind of supposed to fight them. Like it was like, and fucked with me is like sort of interpretable, but it was like if someone called me a name, like if someone, whether it was fat boy or kike or whatever, like it was like, yeah, kick the shit out of them. Like you should hit them. Like it's, they shouldn't, do that. And like, because they kind of broke the law. And I mean, again, not my mom's terms, but those were sort of the rules. And she always had my back for that. So I'd get in trouble at school for getting in a fight. And she'd yell at the principal. And that would, and it would be okay. Never got expelled. That's got just detentions and in-school suspensions, So, yeah. I think that's the basic thing. And then like, as it kind of relates to, I don't know, as it relates to Judaism, on the whole, I mean, I think there is a thing where it's like we have all these laws, and if you operate within the laws, which no one can actually successfully do to, fully, there's so many. But if that's what you're aiming for, then like, what are rules? They're just like they're things put on you by bureaucracies, by institutions that are not God, right? And are not appointed by God. So I think that's what Gurion's logic is. And he's very self-assured of his righteousness. So yeah, right.
There's
I
one
mean,
scene in the book where he's with his dad, and it's Pesach, and his dad goes to buy a bagel, and he gets two bagels, one for him and one for Gurion. And Gurion stands there and kind of goes, "Shit, do I do the kibbutz av ba'aim thing, like honoring my father and mother, or do I eat the bagel?" Because it's Pesach, and he can't eat the bagel. And we don't kind of find out what happens there, but I feel like there's a lot of that where he kind of goes, "Well, I have to do these two things at the same time. I have to like, do I break this law or do I break that law?" And it's funny with that whole erudition kind of side of Gurion. We understand that he will break laws if they, I guess, fulfill the overarching principles of what he believes in.
yeah, or he'll, it's that in a lot of cases, because I think he's, Gurion's, well-intentioned for, as far as, he's concerned, like, yeah, it's either he's going to go for whatever fulfills the overarching principle, or in some cases, if not many, that he's going to choose, he's smart enough to figure out how to argue for the one that he wants to do more, that he wants to break more, that breaking that would fulfill the overarching principle because he's a sharp kid, right?
That's
So
it.
yeah, he's pretty good
Cool.
at, he's pretty good rhetorician. So
Absolutely.
yeah.
One of the touchstones of the book is Philip Roth's Goodbye Columbus, and especially the story of the conversion of the Jews. This, your book, I reread quite a lot of it yesterday, and it just got me right back into that whole Roth thing that I loved that book. I think I read it when I was 17 or 16 or something like that. But in this particular story, in that collection, we meet Ozzie Friedman, who is 12, and he gets hit by his rabbi, and basically he climbs up on the roof of the shul and makes everybody bow down to Jesus. And in your book, Roth also makes a cameo towards the end. But I want to ask you about your relationship to that book and to that story in particular.
I mean, that book was really huge for me, in that I love that. I just think I think Roth is a fantastic writer. It's his first book, and it's the first book I read by him. As far as the story goes, I think that, I really loved that story. And then, but over time, it was like there was something with it that I thought, well, like the exact thing that makes this work, sort of allegorically, is like, because it's not just bow down. He doesn't just have them bow down and say whatever about Jesus Christ. He says he has them, I think before that, he has them all say it's not right to hit people, right? Like it's something like that. And I was like, yeah, I was like, so that's like, that's very winning for that character. And like, it's a short story, and so you roll with it, and you like the character. He's, you know, and he's a sweet kid. He's not a super bright kid. He's just an average, you know, smartish kid. And then I was like, yeah, but what if he likes to hit people? Like, how does he, you know, like the thought was like, it's complicated to say it's not right to hit people. Removes the fact that some people might hit you. And I was like, is it not right to hit people back? And if it is right to hit people back, of course, the problem with that is, you know, when who delivered the first hit when, and this, you know, and we go back. And so in a way, it's always right to hit people. And certainly, like, I think that the spirit of the Old Testament, as I understood it when I was growing up, and I, like, you know, was that it is sometimes right to hit people. Like, it's sometimes right to kill people. Like, it's rare, you know, but there's sometimes when, if you don't hit someone, acting against God, right? Like, if you stand by while somebody is being abused, what do you suppose, you know, is that, is do you fall back on, I'm not supposed to hit people, so I can't do anything about this? What if you can hit them and do something about it? And I think little kids, I think that's how they're, I mean, again, this might be generational, but or regional, I don't know. But like, where I was, it was like kids got in fights all the time. And it was like, you fought because someone messed with your friend or was messing with your friend, and vice versa. Sometimes they're messing with you. Sometimes they're messing with your mom. You know, they say something about her. What are you supposed to do? So you take it as a hit, you hit back. I don't know. So, yeah.
Cool. All right. I want to ask you about Messiah figures because we have them throughout Jewish history. We've got people like Bar Kokhba, who is kind of, I think, the closest in relation to Gurion. We also got people like Shabbatai Tzvi. We can probably throw Jesus in there. We've got Lubavitcher Rebbe, who comes up in this book as well. And he was obviously seen by a lot of his followers as a possible Messiah, even past the point of his death. But tell us about exploring that idea of the book, of these people who may be messiahs, may not be messiahs. I think Gurion in this book, like we see him as a possible messiah, because he does kind of, you know, almost perform miracles at some points. But yeah, tell us about that idea.
Well, I think the whole thing, you know, Gurion's angle on it, and I think this is in line with the overarching sort of Jewish take, is that if there's going to be a Messiah, you know, the Messiah, we're going to know he's the Messiah because he's brought, you know, he's brought the Shabbos, the permanent Shabbos to earth, you know, whatever. Like, it's like everything's going to be perfect, right? Which is in itself a very weird idea, perfection, you know, everything being just. But yeah, the dead are going to rise from the Mount of Olives, and we're all going to be in heart, whatever that belief is. Like, there's a whole bunch of stuff that'll happen that'll be undeniable. But the question for Gurion is like, well, so what about the person who's the Messiah before they enact that stuff? And like, that's one of the notions that allows him to consider the possibility that he's the Messiah. The other one is that, yeah, he's like astoundingly good at fist fights and thinking. And so he's able to take care of himself. He's able to argue with folks and win with adults. And so kids start holding him up as a Messiah. And there's, you know, this notion of there being a Messiah born every generation. It's another Jewish notion. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know about you, Ben. I mean, when I learned that stuff, I was definitely like, so I think deliberately led to believe that it could possibly be me. And I think every other boy in the class was too, you know, like, that was like, it was the notion was, you know, that you should try to be good and just because you might be that guy. Like, and maybe that was just my shul. I mean, I don't know, but it's like, because presumably, if there's a potential one every generation, he can totally fuck up. And so, yeah, so I think that was a compelling thing for me to look at from the perspective of somebody who, you know, conceivably could be. Like, on paper, Gurion looks like, if there's, you know, some kid who might one day be the Messiah, he's probably like, you know, top, you know, 1% of the 1% of the 1% likelihood, you know. So, yeah.
I like the fact that he goes into the fact that, you know, we like even his name, we have like Yehuda in his name or Judah, and
Yeah.
we got that whole story of the Messiah coming from this line of kind of someone who's been born out of a relationship that is incestuous, I suppose. And we have this kind of line that goes down through this Messiah where he is kind of a character who's come from this genealogy that goes into the line of David, which is non-regal birth, let's say. And Gurion like traces his kind of birth to this kind of thing as well.
I mean, yeah, I think like there's, you know, the whole line of Judah thing is like, I mean, it's really weird, like, because like I think I was thinking when I was thinking about this book, you know, today it probably is a, I don't know if it's like as if it speaks as much to today or maybe more than it did, like, but it's like I was thinking, I think obviously when you read it, like a lot about like identity politics stuff or like what was happening in 2010 around that, and like so. You know, Gurion, he's half black, right? And like his mother's Ethiopian. And in the meantime, and this causes a little bit of problems with his when she marries his father. And then in the meantime, like his father has this last name that is that really very, I think some Jews actually do have the last name Maccabee, but very, very few. And like the thing is like all of our names, or at least many, many of our names here in America, at least, they're really adulterated, and they're like, so there's this notion that, you know, if you're coming from, you know, if you were coming from the tribe of Judah, how would you know? Like, there's really like, there's not, we don't have tons of papers. We kept getting expelled from everywhere. Like, it's not, there's no one who can demonstrate that, and so he ends up making this long case, kind of about, yeah, like how his father, well, his name was Makarevich, I think was the name, you know, in Russia. And then he comes over and you're like, where does Makarevich come from? And, you know, Maccabee kind of sounds like Makarevich and is Jewish. And so, but there is that idea that the Messiah is supposed to come from the line of David, and from the line of, you know, it went, you know, purportedly Jesus was the line of David, right? It went Judah. Then I don't know how many deaths, generations later, like 15 or something, David, and then Jesus, and that's the story. But you look at that too, and you're like, really? You know, how do you, how is Jesus from the line of David? Like, that has to be through Mary. I don't know. You know, I'm not a great Torah scholar, but I do think that, like you said, it's like the regal lineage notion is sort of, it's thankfully, I think, pretty hard to, we can't really, since we can't really trace back too far, and any Jew in the world can't really trace back too far where they're from other than Jews, you know, like they have the genetic marker or whatever. It's like, there's no way to determine that. So really, like, that's not, you know, when Messiah comes along, when, if a Messiah were to come along, like, we wouldn't be able to test him in advance and be like, aha, he is the tribe of Judah.
That's
Like,
right.
it's gone, you know, like, and that's kind of a good thing, I think. I don't know. I like it.
Yeah, it does kind of make it a little bit like this idea that anybody can be the Messiah, and it does kind of open it up to a lot of interpretation. But the fact that we know that he's not from a line of prestige, he can be from a line of pretty, adulterated history. We
The only thing you can't be basically is a Kohen, right? Like,
That's
it's
it.
like, because anyone else is sort of Judah, like that, they're all mixed. Everyone else mixed pretty immediately. So I don't know, but
Exactly. Cool. I want to ask you about the structure of the book and also some of the textural elements that you use. But essentially, the book is split in two parts. We've got the site of the damage, which is the first part, and then we have the Gibeonic War, which is the second part. And one of the things you do really well in this book is you use kind of blocks of text to illustrate what rooms look like, or even the design of Gurion's penny gun. But can you tell us about some of those aspects of the book and the way it's set up?
Yeah, I mean, some of the, well, okay, so to begin with, the diagrams, like the diagrams just sort of have everything to do with me having been a younger writer who really wanted the book to sort of pop visually. Pop is such a shit verb. I wanted it to work visually, like, throughout, because I knew that, you know, like, or I had a very strong sense, let's say, as it was going forward, that there was going to be this very massive, like, sort of war scene at the end, which, and So I wanted to establish a way to for a reader to be able to map what was happening, and like I actually honored it. Like there's nothing that sort of happens in that scene that like ever I you know you could trace lines and it would all like with a little map that's given and it would all happen. It would be practical, so to speak, that it would happen this way. And so that was important to me. And also I was younger and I wasn't super confident in my ability to describe things like that, because I guess I'm not super confident now. I just kind of don't do it if I, you know, like you know. And so I thought I could do this with these diagrams. This will be a strong way this would communicate to me. And there was also this notion that, you know, the book that the book gets into, where the universe is fundamentally made of words. These 10 words that God speak, the ten Sephirot. They're held together all the time, and that the world is held together all the time by God speaking these at this like very rapid rate or something like that. That's how I always imagined it when it was, you know, told to me. But and if you were to stop for a second, everything would just disappear. Like, but it's actually spoken into existence as it goes forward. And so I thought, yeah, like Gorian would map using words as diagrams. So he'd write the word chair or whatever in the shape of a chair, you know. It's not, I don't think that's how seat legs, you know. And then there were just like some things that I thought were, you know, like kind of funny, because the book's, you know, hopefully funny. And it's like there's the Ten Sephirot, like the tree of life or tree of man, and then the tree of man, you know, like I can't remember which Sephiro, Sephiro it is the it's the dick.
I think it's your sod. I
It's
think it's
like
your sod for memory.
so your son, yeah. So your son is, you know, this penis coming out of the center of a stick man with legs, you know, and it's like, I don't know. And I just thought that that was, it was fun for me. It was like I made that diagram pretty early and like just sort of myself laugh, and I was like, that's gonna go in. So yeah. And then, as far as the structure goes, like of the first and second book, I think there was just this idea that the book is really actually like I don't want to say plot driven is like it sounds different. That sounds like I'm talking about like a spy thriller or something. But I feel like there's sort of these two arcs, and the second arc is bigger, but the first one we get to at the end of book one, and then the second one is, you know, the end of book two. And there's this shift too. It also gives this opportunity to sort of look forward a bit. Just like there's a lot of like, because the book, the perspective of the book, Gorian's perspective when he's writing it, is some years after the events he's describing, and you kind of don't know where he is, and it's like sort of cluing you in a little bit. That gets referred to at different points. And that structure helps do that.
One of the things that he refers to is the word damage, which he comes back to quite a lot. And like one of the phrases that we see on the new cover as well is like we the damage, or we damage we.
Yeah,
Tell us
we.
about that idea of damage, because it comes up in this book fairly frequently.
Yeah, I mean, I think that well, it's this idea where you have this, so first, you know, he's this violent kid who's constantly justifying, sometimes more convincingly than others, justifying to himself the violence that he's doing as being sort of, you know, holy. And so damage, so he, and violence is damage, and you know, he so he wants to make sense of that. And then there are all these friends that he has that are not Jewish, who are not subject to the laws of Judaism, anything like this. But he loves them, and he wants to sort of make sense of them being these people that he's very close with. And they happen also all be in this kind of behavioral disorder program where they're being told they're damaged all the time. And so he's kind of like, let's own that, you know. And you can maybe look at the history of the Jews as being like, we've suffered a lot of damage, you know. So that matched with the idea that in Judaism, that, you know, everyone I think is pretty familiar with, you know, from the last, you know, 30 years at least, it seemed like it was going everywhere, of sort of that what we're here to do as humans is perfect the world, is sort of like, and And that Gurion's so Gurion from the beginning, there's a prayer where he's talking basically about perfecting the world by inflicting damage on certain parts of it, by inflicting damage on the damaged parts of it. It's a twisty kind of logic for him. But it gives him a lot of sort of rhetorical escape routes. If he's acting like a dick, he can convince himself he was acting justly. And sometimes he is acting justly, and like a dick, so.
I love the way he kind of weaponizes this concept, and it's almost taken as like a scriptural term, I think, within the book. I think it's really taken on as almost a Torah precept, I suppose, like a mitzvah to do this damage.
That's kind of the premise he's going from, like, is that, we have to do damage. I mean, like, again, like what we were talking about a bit earlier, like, this idea that sometimes you actually have to fight in order to do the right thing. You have to hit someone. And it's like, what is that if not inflicting damage? And if God made this world where you need to inflict damage, how do you explain that? How do you,
One of the things in this book that reminded me of Bubblegum as well is when we talk about damage that Gurion does, it kind of reminded me straight away about the swing set murders that happen in Bubblegum. But do you want to tell us about that idea of just the willful destruction of stuff that adolescents do and kind of how joyful that is in a way?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you just said it. It's I think that there is a thing that, like, when you're a, when I'm a when I was a kid, at least, and I think a lot of kids, a lot of boys at least, there's a lot of fun to be had in destroying things and like getting and beating people up, like getting in fights. Not like bullying someone, but like the physicality of, violence is really thrilling for a kid, I think, or for a lot of kids in a way that most of those kids, that they don't find it thrilling when they're a little older. And so I think that they do tap similar things. Like, first of all, there's like an exertion of power. You're a kid, and like you don't have much power, and now you can exert power for a moment. But there really is just that kind of feeling of, you can get hit. It's always, for me, it was always surprising when I would get in fights how little it actually hurt to get in a fight. Like, I remember the first time I got punched in the nose, and I saw the blood, and I jumped on this kid, and it was really intense, but it wasn't from pain. My nose didn't hurt. My nose surprisingly didn't hurt much at all, even though it was gushing blood. I was just like angry and full of sort of righteous indignation, and I exerted it. And I think that, that's a situation where, like I said, my nose blood didn't break, and like, had someone hit me full on like that, even 3 years later, 4 years later, they would have been stronger. My nose would not have been any stronger, probably would have broken. So I think one of the joys of fighting when you're a kid, is that you really can't do that much damage to each other. Like, you think you're doing, it's more about, dominance in a way. But also just the fun of it. Like, the fun of, like, I have this body, I can use it. Even though it's small, to like win something. I don't know. And with Bubblegum and the swing set murders, I think similarly, like, there is something where I just, like, when I thought with that book, when I was writing that part, I was just thinking, about how fun it was to just break shit. Especially, other people's shit. It's like there's again, you just like, I'm not so sure what it is, because it definitely doesn't thrill me anymore. Like, I don't see a car and think, man, I want to key that car, or I want to shatter its window. Like, it's just not a thought that occurs to me. It doesn't sound like fun. Even if I thought I could get away with it, it just seems like a weird kind of dumb thing to do. When I was a kid, it was just like, I could break this thing and I'm not allowed to, but I still won't get in trouble. And it's there's a thrill to that. I don't know. That's the best I can do when it comes to that.
There is some kind of thrill, like as Gorion in this book, he's using his balloon penny gun thing to try and just shoot a clock. He wants to smash the clock face. And so obsessed about getting the numbers right with his calculations about when he should break the clock, if it's like 10:27 or 10:28 or whatever it is. And not wanting to wait till 10:36 for whatever reason. But there's this like childhood joy. Like I like rereading that, there's something so joyful about the idea of trying to smash something with, your own little gun. And he's going from pennies to quarters and things like that, trying to find wing nuts and stuff like that. But there is this kind of just prodigious joy in those passages in your book about destruction. There's a scene where he like throws a stapler at his teacher and it just cuts him across the eye. There is some joy within that. And it kind of goes back to, like things like Lord of the Flies or whatever, like just this idea of kind of violence for violence sake. And just that play with, this idea of this red haze that comes over people. I remember Gurion saying, like in the book, that he can just explode at any time. And he kind of does within this book. But yeah, it is joyful and it's fun and it's funny.
And I mean, I think you said, use kind of a good verb there. I mean, like, there's, you said, just play. I mean, you're using it in different contexts, but I think that that's the other thing is there's something to fighting, at least when I was a kid. Like, when I look back on it, it does actually seem like what a lot of people describe as, playing. Like, and I think that's kind of how, we looked at there. There's higher, it's like slightly high stakes playing, but you look at little animals, like little mammals, and they're constantly wrestling and dominating each other, right? And like never killing each other. They're like or even really wounding each other in most cases. They're just like trying to win, and like and they're it's a very physical thing. And there's, yeah, I don't know if that's, maybe that's all it is. Maybe it's just the animal in us, like, but yeah, I definitely don't have that anymore. I don't think most adults do. I think that's probably really good. that it goes away. But yeah, there's a lot of joy in that. That's being a kid in my mind.
This is a contention that I've kind of grown to believe fully now that I think that Avner Landys helped me develop. But I'm pretty sure, I'm confident that this book, in my contention anyway, is probably the most authentic and unapologetically Jewish book since Goodbye Columbus, if not ever. I want you to, and I think this is in terms of like the concepts that you drop in. You don't really worry about explaining anything. There's not a glossary at the back. There's not any textual explanation of what's happening. You just drop us into this world of Gurion. And the depth and the Talmudic kind of erudition within the book, it makes it feel like the whole book, make it feel like a piece of apocrypha, right? Like, and I'm talking old school apocrypha, like as in things that were excised from the Torah because they didn't fit in with things, which I think makes this book like it's presented as a book of scripture. This is kind of emphasized by the fact that at the beginning of the book, you say this is like a translation by two of his followers. So we get this kind of gospel like sense to this book. But I want to ask you about that aspect of a book being a piece of scripture.
Yeah, I mean, well, from the angle of the book, like, so the big conceit when it comes to that is that yeah, like Gurion has these two friends slash followers, and he's written the first half in English and he's written the second half in Hebrew, and he had them each translate each section back and forth, right, without seeing each other's translation. And so he, for example, he takes the first book. He gives it to the one follower to translate into Hebrew. And then he tells that follower to give that Hebrew version to the other follower without showing him the English version, and has that follower translate it back into English. And when Gurion's claim is that he translates it back into English and it's identical. And therefore, the book is perfect. And then he does the same just in reverse with the second book. And like, he's really he the whole time nods to not nods I mean openly states that he's writing scripture, which is a strange thing for a little boy to do, or anybody these days, right? And so the notion with it being scripture is that it would harmonize perfectly with previous scripture and be canonized. So his claim is you're basically supposed to take this as seriously as you would take Torah, more so even than Talmud. Like, this is like which is pretty, if the claim is that it harmonizes, which his is, that shouldn't inherently be sacrilegious. But
What you're talking about with the idea that this book is kind of, perfect. It got me thinking about that idea of when the Torah was translated from Hebrew to Greek, they did exactly the same thing. They got, people to do it blindly in a way and ensure that it was exactly the same. But yeah, so that idea comes back to this whole idea of perfection.
Nice. I actually didn't know that. That's cool. That's nice.
Yeah,
Maybe it is.
no.
Maybe it is a perfect prescription for
Yeah, that's
that.
it. Is there anything else you want to tell us about this book? Because I feel like, I don't know, this having the opportunity to reread this book, I think, is just such a privilege because it is well within my top 10 of all time books because I think this is just something
Thanks,
that
man.
is, it's just so different and it fits this whole line of, I guess, these massive tomes that we all love. But I don't know. I just, is there any other things that you want to tell us about writing this book and having it re-released now?
Well, I mean, I would say like one thing you were asking before, you were saying before is this very nice compliment of being very unapologetically Jewish. And
Yeah.
like I think it is unapologetically Jewish, but the hope was that a lot of the stuff that things make sense contextually, that Guri makes sense of them contextually. Like I was certainly trying to be conscious of that. But yeah, so there's that. Which is not, it's not apologetic. I think a lot of the stuff, like there's even like, there's a version of the story of the Garden of Eden that like most Jews I know don't know, that's in there. I was like, so I was trying to put everything kind of tell it as anecdotally as like story positive as possible. But yeah, and I think that, the thing is like with it, I mean, there's what you try to do and what you hear you did and like what ended up happening. And I think that what I was trying to do was write this intense involving book that hopefully does some weird things formally and stylistically, some that are enjoyable, but I wanted it to really be fun. So it's like the thought as I was going forward was it needs to move faster and faster as it proceeds, and I think it does that. Like it's like so and I think a lot of times people see a big book, and for a good reason, a lot of times, think, oh, this is going to be like this slow, like encyclopedic read. And my hope was like it would have an effect where you came out of it and you felt like you had been fully immersed and you had like thought new kinds of thoughts. But in the meantime, like it would be fun for that to happen. That would happen sort of under the hood. Like, so I don't know. So I, and that's, I think that's all. Yeah, that's the way I remember approaching it. Yeah, and I don't know. I like I said, I when I've never, not never, but I think I read it right when it was published, and then I reread it to revise it a bit. But even that revision process was so like tight-assed that it was very small things. It was like I was looking for typos and misprints basically, and a lot of words. And so I kind of blew my chance maybe to read it, try to read it like the way I wanted it read, which is, you're like sitting down to enjoy a book and you just read it fast. So, I don't know, but maybe in another 10 years, I'll read it again, and I won't have to revise it again. So, that would
Okay.
be good.
I'm not going to give anything away at the end of this book. Not that it's a spoiler because it's kind of, it's set up at the beginning of the book, but I want to ask you about if Gurren is someone you'd ever go back to revisit and like what do you think he'd be doing now?
What he'd be doing now, I mean, like, I'll tell you the truth, man. I don't really think about that stuff much. Like, when I'm done with a book, like, I'm so done with it. But, like, what I did think about, if I'm being honest, which why wouldn't I be? Like, with that book, like, I thought about potentially what other characters, where other characters would be. Because Gorian to me is like, the book reaches a point where I feel like I could make any number of decisions if I were to do like a sequel or something, but like none of them are appealing to me. Like, whereas like thinking about like some of the other kids in the book is sort of appealing to me. But not enough that in the 13 years since I've ever tried to do anything about that. But titles flash through my head and then I'm like, oh, like I don't know, sometimes, but yeah, so yeah, I mean, yeah, and I definitely don't know how to talk about what he'd be doing right now without spoilering things. What he might be doing. So, yeah. Did you have some notion?
I don't, it's funny because I feel like where he is at the end of the book is kind of like a fitting place to leave him. But he is someone who I kind of, I don't know, when I did my bit of rereading this time around, it's funny because I feel like he almost like could pop up anywhere at the moment. Like I feel like he'd be a great voice on Twitter to have around or somewhere like that. Like I think it'd be really interesting just to see what he would come up with. And I don't know, I think this book is so well, like this voice is just so well developed that I feel like I can just hear him thinking about all sorts of things at the moment, some of the interesting perspectives he might have on how things are going. So yeah.
I mean, what's bizarre is to think, like, I think he'd be, because yeah, if like if there were a book that was that had Gurion in it and it were set today, he'd be 28 years old. So
Yeah, it's
it's
crazy.
like that's just weird for me. I can't really picture him.
Yeah.
But now I kind of want to, so hey.
After this re-release and this celebration, after the hangover has worn off from the Bar Mitzvah celebration and reception of the book, are you working on something at the moment? Like what's coming out next for you?
I am working on something. It's not finished, so when it would be coming out next, or if it will get finished, is up for grabs. But I've been working on something for pretty steady for I'd say about almost 18 months.
Wow.
So,
Okay.
yeah, hopefully, I think it's going to be short, which is going to be interesting because I've
Cool.
never done that.
Okay.
But yeah.
Awesome. Can't wait. I
Cool.
want to ask you about Camille's book because that's coming out very soon. I
Sure.
think June, isn't it? Tell us a bit about
Yeah,
that.
June. It's called The Material, and it's set in a fictional school in Chicago, graduate program, MFA in stand-up comedy. And it's sort of a day in the life of these students and teacher, and there's some plot stuff that, again, spoilers are not my thing, so I keep quiet on that. But there's it's a very funny book, and it's really like her last book. It's very I don't know, it's she has this thing where you can get into the heads of characters really rapidly and really intensely, and care about them. And there's a lot of characters in this book, and it's sort of there's I think there's probably like I call it like say like six main characters, and then like a few secondary characters that are bigger in a way in one's imagination than most main characters usually are. And yeah, and it's like, but it's real fast, it's real funny, and yeah, I don't know. And I find it, it's ultimately like it's kind of sad the way the way a book should be.
Who's it? Who's it coming out through?
Through Random House.
Okay, awesome. And I think it's July 4th. I think that's the date I've got here.
I think it's June 11th. Oh, you might be you're, are you looking at the UK publication?
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah. The
Okay,
UK
cool.
might be a couple weeks later. That
Yeah.
sounds that's correct.
Yeah, I'm just
Yeah.
looking at, yeah, it's UK Serpent's Tale, July 4. So, okay. And then,
Yeah.
cool. I cannot wait for that. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, man. I think you'll dig it. I think you'll dig it for sure. Yeah.
Nice. I want to ask you briefly, we talked about reading earlier and not doing as much reading as you might have done, but is there anything currently that you're reading that you can recommend for us?
Well, I actually just I did a one of these it's not fiction. It's I but I did one of these events with Lauren Euler, the In Conversation things, and
Yeah.
so I read her latest book, and I really enjoyed that. And it's
Okay.
I'm trying to think fiction-wise, like, it's really been a while. Like we were like it was it's not, and I definitely don't want to mention these, but I think I've put down in the last like 4 months, I've probably put down like 17 books. And I was
Wow.
just like, I can't do this. And it probably has more to do with what I'm working on than anything else, where I'm sort of getting some mode where I don't want to see
Other people's work.
other people sound,
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm trying. You know what I read there? So I read the Euler, and then the last thing I read, it was just last week, I read the new Colin Barrett, Wild Houses, and I think that guy is a great writer. And so I really enjoyed that one. I enjoyed his stories for years, and this was yeah, it's just a very involving book. Have you ever read Barrett?
No, I haven't.
Oh, he's quite good, man. He's it's th there's like. I don't know, he's an Irish guy. Like, I feel like these Irish guys, man, they have a thing with English that I can't access. That's so lovely. That's like,
Yeah.
It's like him and Keith Ridgway are really exciting to me as writers right now. And
Okay.
yeah. So fun
Cool.
book.
Okay. I'll have to put that on my list. Sounds good. I should wrap it up with you. I could chat all day about the amazing instructions. It's just so lovely to think that I'm going to get this beautiful two volume edition slapping on the door very soon. But absolute pleasure chatting with you. Mazel tov. Congratulations on the bar mitzvah of this great book.
Thanks a lot, Pat. It was great talking, man, as usual.
Thanks once again to Adam Levine. The Instructions Bar Mitzvah edition is available from McSweeney's. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with the next episode very soon. Life has a way of